Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Hahn and I'm here with my co-host Tim Hemming.
Hey Jen. We are via Skype.
We are via Skype. Modern technology, am I right? So in light of our amazingly popular first episode of the Brexit News Roundup, we've decided to do it again this week, not having Tim do it alone this time, which should be quite interesting. So Tim, the most important thing I think that's happened since last week is Theresa May's big Easter speech. Tell us about that. Inform me.
Well, you say the most important thing is probably just the biggest Brexit news item. I'm not sure whether anyone who looks into the detail would say it's the most important. It's just made the most noise. Our Prime Minister has spoken of a sense of people coming together following the UK's vote to leave the EU. So in May's Easter message, now May is the daughter of a vicar and she does say she holds strong Christian values, but those can be values that are shared by other religions and people of no religion as well, covering all bases there. She says, this year, after a period of intense debate over the right future for our country, there is a sense that people are coming together and uniting behind the opportunities that lie ahead. So I think there was a few commentators there said, really, Theresa? Is that really what's happening? Now, obviously, that was an opportunity then for the opposition to get the knives out. Perhaps most vocal amongst those was Alistair Campbell, formerly ex-Prime Minister Tony Blair's right-hand man. He's now the editor-at-large of the pro-EU weekly newspaper, The New European. He says, I don't think I've ever known Britain more divided. As for her talk of compassion, community, citizenship and obligations to one another, she's taken an axe to those with regard to Britain's relations with the rest of the world and plenty of her domestic agenda points in the opposite direction. I think, again, opinion is divided over whether Britain is divided, Jen.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I'm quite curious where she sees the evidence for this. I'm assuming she doesn't have any, but just everything I've heard continues to be divisive. So
there is a poll out that says that 55% of people are now happy with the situation after the EU referendum and are happy that we're ploughing ahead with Brexit. Now, that would be up 4 points from the EU referendum last year. The other thing about what Theresa, she had to say something and she had to come out with a positive Easter message. It's a bit like the Queen's speech at Christmas time.
So it doesn't really mean anything.
She can't really stand up and say the country's completely ripped down the middle and we're in a hopeless situation, even if she thought that was the case. So I thought that was that. That's it. So she has to put a spin of positivity on it, which you would understand.
Yeah, but it could have just been something along the lines of like showing inclusivity in her speech herself for a change and, you know, welcoming people of different nationalities from the EU and maybe guaranteeing them the right to remain. That would have been a positive thing to say over Easter rather than just, clearly we're all coming together behind this now, without showing any evidence of that in her actions herself.
Yeah, I guess it is. Perhaps it's one of the things we could have leveled at Theresa May throughout this, is that the devil's in the detail and she doesn't go into enough detail.
Yeah.
And perhaps she's might be also stuck a little bit in her Tory echo chamber.
Then again, aren't we all? But anyway, moving on to the second point. Hit me with more Brexit news. What else has happened, Tim?
More Brexit news. Well, worries over transparency surrounding the negotiations. The EU Commission Chief Brexit Negotiator Michael Barnier has talked about the importance of transparency, but there are very real fears that he might not be quite so open to that.
I mean, this wouldn't just come from the EU side, though, because as we just mentioned, it's not like Theresa May has been especially like transparent in the way that she's handled Brexit this far. So I think if the talks are going to be very, I suppose, opaque, if you want to call it that, then, which I'm expecting that there will be, I think that's going to come from both sides, not just from the EU's chief negotiator.
I think it has come from both sides at the moment. The European Ombudsman, Emily O'Reilly, has demanded a transparent Brexit. There are millions of citizens potentially affected by Brexit. O'Reilly said it's very important that people see where things are going. Personally, I think I'd echo that. it feels like to have some sort of positive relations going forward, there needs to be more transparency, because otherwise you end up with sort of conspiracy theories and suspicion all around, I would suggest.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably happening at the moment, as you see with so much of any of the kind of news that comes out around Brexit. It's just a lot of hearsay of like, this might happen, some people say this might happen, da da da, and it just goes around in these massive circles of speculation, which I'm assuming, I think that will happen going forward as well, to be honest, because everything's so uncertain and there's so little detail given by anyone, which makes sense that they wouldn't give out any detail yet, because if anything, that's just going to complicate negotiations. But at the same time, transparency is supposed to be at the heart of democracy, right?
Well, I'd have thought so. The other thing I thought about this is it's not just relations between Britain and the EU, but it's also internally, if there is a lack of transparency. So, for example, let's say the British government strike another deal for car manufacturers, and yet it is struck behind the scenes, and we don't really know what the details of that are. But then that could be at the expense of another section of our industry, like the agricultural sector, for example, and therefore you are going to get a lot more mistrust. So I think, would it not be better to have everything out in the open as much as possible?
Yeah, or even on the level of immigration, say some kind of deal gets decided behind the scenes, but people don't hear about it until we actually exit in 2 years, and then it's sort of like thrust upon them from one day to the other, and then they need to make these big life decisions within no time, rather than having some time to prepare for it, because the government's transparent about what it's aiming for its citizens and what the EU is aiming for theirs.
Yeah, people are going to find out ultimately, because the proof's going to be in the pudding, right?
Yeah, hopefully.
Let's stick with immigration for point three.
Okay, go on then.
This was picked up on a piece from the Sky News political editor, Faisal Islam, and he calls it the Brexit and student migration paradox. So, citing the example of Sunderland University, which is the fourth biggest provider of transnational education from the UK, according to its vice-chancellor. So it's just looking at the thing that foreign students coming in to learn at our universities are effectively boosting our exports. And yet the government have migration figures, stated migration figures to get migration down. And so the kind of the contrast that actually, if you have foreign students coming to pay, that's good for the economy, whilst at the same time you're trying to have less migration coming into the country. So the upshot of this has been the international arrivals leading into the quarter of September last year, which is obviously the start of the academic year, were the lowest since 2002. The numbers coming in from East Asia, including China, is down from 49,000 to 38,000. From South Asia, including the large Commonwealth nations, just 7,000 students arrived in September. And that's fewer than arrived from Central and South America. A year before, it was 12,000, and 5 years ago, it was 91,000. So we've had major summit meeting discussions from Theresa May with India's Prime Minister, where India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been asking about visas for Indian students, and Theresa May has been asking him to help return Indian visa overstayers in this country. Not typical things that you would discuss at major summits. So one solution to this is suggested by the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, and Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, is that we exempt foreign students from the migration targets. But obviously, if foreign students aren't turning up, then it potentially, for the government who want to get migration down, makes those targets, those figures, that sort of massages those figures. Mm. Hence the paradox. That all makes sense?
Yep. For anyone that's interested in this, by the way, before I respond to this a little, we have an entire episode 45 with Sally Hunt from the UCU, who talks about the general state of the UK education sector, higher education sector, and EU students coming in. So if you're interested in that, go check that out. But I think I wouldn't I'm not surprised by the fact that the number has gone down, because first of all, the entire tone that's come from the British government on students or even just immigrants in general coming into the country has been so negative. And with EU students potentially being subject to international student fees, which are exponentially higher than EU student fees, with them maybe not being able to access student loans anymore, with them maybe not being able to get jobs in the country afterwards, I'm really not surprised that the number has gone down that much, even for people who aren't from the EU, as you said, a lot of Asian countries as well, because the general tone that Theresa May is setting by saying we need to have less people coming into this country, even though immigrants add so much, I think, is just completely discouraging.
This is quite a hot topic for you, isn't it?
Well, clearly, because I'm a student that came here. So, I mean, I think every time we've talked about this, I've gotten quite riled up. So I think people may be sick of hearing about it. But I, coming here to study was the best decision of my life. And I'm working here now and I'm contributing to this economy and I'm not falling on anyone's pocket. I'm spending money here, I'm paying rent here, I'm paying taxes and NHS like everybody else. So I really don't understand, like, I'm not taking anybody's job. It's just, yeah, I find it really sad.
I did notice in the, actually it was in the Sun today, that there's potentially, I just quickly grabbed the headline, that there was going to be a barista, an influx of baristas, or some special exceptions made for baristas, so that migrants can come and work in coffee shops, and that was one of them.
That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Okay.
What in the world is that? We won't take you for any of the good jobs, but you can serve our fucking coffee. What in the world?
Well, hang on. I mean, like, actually, baristas is quite a skilled profession.
Listen, let's not get into technicalities of it. It's the fact that, like...
Let me just pull this story up a second. Home Secretary Amber Rudd is looking at introducing new barista visas to ensure coffee shops and bars keep EU staff after Brexit. Under the plan, young European citizens will be able to come to the UK and work in the hospitality industry when we leave the EU. But their time will be strictly limited to 2 years and they won't be able to claim benefits for housing.
Why would that be appealing to anybody? Why does someone in, like, the Sun in Spain think, you know what I want to do? I want to move to England for 2 years to surf coffee in the rain.
It's based on the current youth mobility scheme for travellers from Australia, New Zealand and Canada.
I'm sorry, but no.
And she argues it solves the labour problem faced by restaurants and bars when Britain leave the EU and ends freedom of movement. But as the workers here won't be long term, they won't add pressure on the already groaning public services.
This is ridiculous. It's literally because they've realised that the EU people that are here are doing all the jobs that English people don't want to do, like bar work or like being a barista. So they're like, oh shit, we don't have anyone to fill these positions once we exit the EU, so better keep those. And then, oh yeah, let's keep finance as well. Oh yeah, let's keep automotive as well. We'll just end up keeping everything. That's not how it works.
Is it not a generalisation to say that British people don't want to do those jobs?
Oh, it massively is. I'm just saying, it's like, just the idea of saying we want to keep foreigners to do the low-level, badly paying, like, low-skilled jobs, but you can fuck off for everything else, is so demeaning. Like, you can't get a proper job. But sorry, I'm getting really angry about this. Maybe let's talk about something else. I apologize. Sorry, dear listeners. You feel free to rip me apart on Twitter for this. I don't mind.
Let's move forward.
Yes. Tim, tell me about more Brexit news. What else has happened?
Well, it's not just the breaks on migration. We've also put the brakes, Brexit has also put the brakes on new laws. New laws in Britain, this was from the Financial Times, fell to their lowest level for two decades. They fell by 29% last year, I think that is. Yeah, I think that's last year, to 1,642 when the Tories won the last general election, so got shot of the Liberals and the coalition. The new laws were up by 12% to 2,301. So, I mean, it's pretty clear that Brexit is at the forefront of a government's mind. Therefore, all the law, legal resources have been pooled into that. But what this could mean is that there are fears that other important laws might go by the wayside or at least be put on hold for now. For example, laws to cut energy bills for housing and restrict foreign takeovers of British companies, British business, have all been put on hold. So the piece in the Financial Times is just flagging that up. I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, although I suppose there was always going to be, once the Great Repeal Bill comes into effect and then all the EU law becomes UK law and we start picking and choosing what we want and what we don't want, I think there's going to be such a huge overhaul of stuff again. So deciding things now seems... Well, I don't know if it would be the same stuff that gets decided on. I suppose this isn't EU regulation that's gotten to the sidelines now, so maybe it would be unaffected. But it seems like this is the bigger fish to fry, I suppose, and there just isn't enough staff. Maybe the solution would be to hire more staff, but they've already been doing that, but all it's been going into is Brexit, hasn't it?
I think so. I guess it makes sense that before you start bringing in even more new laws, you need to work out how you're going to pretty much incorporate and adopt the ones that you've currently got from Europe.
Yeah, although I suppose they apply to different things, like the ones you just mentioned. I'm assuming they aren't covered under EU law, which is why they're being decided nationally at the moment, right?
That would be fair. I don't know, is my honest answer on that, or whether there is some kind of overlap.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, it's just a lot of work to be done. Well, our final point from the Daily Telegraph. It's good news, Jen, because what we're going to do is the scrap EU green energy targets when we leave the European Union, because at the moment they add more than £100 to our average energy bills. So as the Telegraph say, we're going to burn the bonfire of red tape after Brexit. This story is we're currently committed to getting 15% of all energy from renewable sources such as wind and solar by 2020. It's a target we have got absolutely no chance of hitting, according to the experts, because the target excludes nuclear power, carbon capture, or any other gains from sort of energy efficient means. We're currently going to incur millions of pounds in fines from the European Union, if we were, I suppose, to stay in it. But the good news, if you... potentially good news for the economy, or potentially bad news, I suppose, if you're an environmentalist, is that as we move out of the European Union, and we will likely to scrap the EU Renewable Energy Directive. Owen Paterson, a Tory MP, former Environment Secretary, said, "It's distorting the whole energy market. It's like the Sheriff of Nottingham. It transfers money from my poorest constituents to my wealthiest constituents, who are putting up pointless wind turbines, heavily subsidised. I would be very happy to see the back of it. The Telegraph reckons that the cost is £120 billion. And I did notice a commentator on one of the pieces I looked at saying, all of these figures are cockshies and no one will really know the answer till we start to make actual savings after Brexit. So there you have it. Thoughts?
I can't believe that the focus is, hey, we're saving money by not having to pay fines, when the thing that's at risk is just this little small thing, like the continuing existence of the human species and like Earth itself. They need to get their priorities straight. They need to get their priorities straight. In what universe is it more important to save money? That's such a short-sighted view.
Wouldn't be as hard line as you. I don't know that the EU Renewable Energy Directive is as effective as perhaps some of the pro-environmentalists might make out. And I think that's what you would, that would be the argument from the likes of the Telegraph and the likes of Owen Paterson. He says it's just not, simply not effective.
Are they introducing any kind of alternatives to it? Or is it just going to get scrapped and then we're not going to have any kind of target?
That is something that we should probably investigate. Maybe we should get Owen Paterson on and find out.
Let's do that. Let's get Owen Paterson on.
We know you're a listener.
Okay, was that the last piece of Brexit news, or do you have anything else you want to share?
Just a very final thought. I was just having a read through, and I dropped on a piece from The Guardian, and it was about the border in between the Northern Ireland and the Republic, and the writer of the report had dropped into Macrish's general store and funeral directors, and Sean Keighley had come in looking for something for breakfast, and they're discussing Brexit, and the store itself is right on the border, and he said of Theresa May, "It's like being led by a blind tortoise." And then he added that his own children wouldn't know where the border was, even though they live barely half a mile from it.
Well, that's quite poignant, isn't it?
So more border discussions. Apparently there are around 200 crossings along the border's 310-mile length, which is a tenfold rise from the height or depth of the Troubles when unapproved roads were blocked or even dynamited by the army. And there are some signs going up now. There's some black and yellow signs going up on some of the roads in the border to say that
this road
may be shut as we leave the EU.
Oh, wow. Okay. Are they official signs? Are these just people putting up their own sign?
Yeah, I don't think they've been put up by the Brexiteers.
Yeah, I was just about to say, that doesn't sound right. Okay.
That's my lot for the Brexit news review for this week.
Well, thanks, Tim, as ever, for keeping us well informed. Check back next Tuesday if you want to get another Brexit news roundup. And on Thursday for our regular interview episode, you can subscribe to us wherever you're listening to this podcast, or check us out at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. The show is produced by myself, Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Pohl, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.